Good afternoon. It's great to see everyone. Welcome back to the 2018 session, and this is our first official meeting of the Education Finance Committee for this year's session. So it's great to see you all. I guess we'll just go ahead and get started with approval of the minutes. We did have an interim joint hearing with the property tax division, and we're glad for those of you who are able to join us for that meeting with just an informational hearing on property taxes and a proposal that Representative Drazkowski has. Would anyone like to move approval of the minutes? Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair, I'll move approval of the February 13, 2018 joint hearing between Education Finance and Property Tax and Local Government Finance.
All right. We have a motion. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any discussion? Thank you, Representative Juergens. All right. Any questions? If not, all in favor of the motion of adopting those minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Minutes are approved. Thank you. Yes. And so we have new pages with us this year. And so I've had a chance to just say hello to each of them briefly, but we're really excited that they're here with us. We have Hannah Kunisch and Maddie Norgaard. So Hannah is over here to my left, and Maddie over here. So I would like each of you to stand up, and we'll go ahead and start with you, Hannah. And if there's anything you'd like to tell us about yourself, please do. somehow I think those skills are going to be transferable. I don't know. Thank you. Well, we're really glad you're here with us. And Maddie.
I'm Maddie Norgaard. I grew up in North Minneapolis, and I most recently moved back to Minneapolis after living in Finland.
Wonderful. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much to both of you. We're very, very pleased to have you with us. And I know our pages always do awesome work for the committee, so thank you so much. We enjoy having you here with us. So and one little bit of housekeeping just for your folders, and this helps us stay organized. If you want any of the materials in your folder saved, please put them in the save folder in your packets. If it's not in the save folder, it is going to get recycled. And do also keep in mind, if you put it in the save folder, it's going to be there, and make sure you want to keep it, because sometimes these folders start to get very large, and it's a little unwieldy to keep things organized. So that is my housekeeping announcement, and I'm guilty of that because I like paper, and I hang on to it way too much. So, but if any of you are more disciplined, good for you. So with that, today we're going to start off with an overview. We had a supplemental appropriations bill in 2016, and so a lot of that was some one-time funding and some pilot programs that we were able to fund, and so we thought it would be good to kind of kick off the committee this session to talk about some of those pilot programs and the funding, how they're going, what's being done, and then we'll kind of move on from there to some other topics. But so we've got great testifiers here to talk about these programs. We're first going to hear from the Office of Higher Education. We have provided some money for alternative teacher prep programs, grant programs, a student teaching grant program, and teacher loan forgiveness programs. So we have two representatives from the Office of Higher Education, Nikki Oliver and Megan Fitzgibbon. I hope I pronounced your names correctly. All right. So thank you for being here. If you would each just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Chair Loon, committee members. My name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Grants and Government Relations Manager for the Office of Higher Education. And I'll be speaking specifically to the Alternative Teacher Prep Program, and Megan manages the other programs that are mentioned.
Very good. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but members, there are a number of these green packets in your folder for today's meeting. And so I'm not sure if they're in the order in which we're taking them up, but you will want to look at the one that says Alternative Teacher Preparation Grant Program. We'll be looking at those. Will be the supplemental materials for this discussion. So, all right. Thank you, Ms. Oliver. Please go ahead.
So last session, during the special session, we were, the office through the education bill was appropriated $750,000, one-time funding in fiscal year 2018, for a grant program for alternative teacher programs that fill teacher shortages. This is a competitive grant program. Therefore, the office has to develop a request for proposals, application, and grading review criteria for the program. And because this program is not something that our office is familiar with, I've been doing a lot of background research on the topic and talking with stakeholders. I have provided you with a timeline for the program. I have been keeping quite a few stakeholders in the loop on the process here, and we anticipate having the RFP available March 5th for the program.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Oliver at this point? All right. We may come back to you, but thank you very much. All right. Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Megan Fitzgibbon. I am a state financial aid manager for the Office of Higher Education, and I have been administering the teacher candidate grant program and the teacher shortage loan forgiveness program for the last year and couple of years now. I'm going to start with the teacher candidate grant program. This program was originally set in law as the Grants to Student Teachers program, and in the last legislative session was changed to the Teacher Candidate Grant. It provides financial assistance to students who are enrolled in undergraduate and graduate programs in Minnesota schools that are approved to provide teacher prep. And students can receive up to $7,500 in one semester. And that semester that they receive that is the one when they're doing their 12-week or more student teaching requirement for their licensure. And in order for them to qualify, they do have to either intend to work in a shortage area, which is defined in the statute, or have to belong to a racial or ethnic group underrepresented in the teacher workforce, Minnesota teacher workforce. One important factor with this program that's unique is that the statute requires the office to reserve a certain amount of funds, a percentage of funds, for those teacher candidates who belong to racial or ethnic groups that are underrepresented in the teacher workforce. And that percentage is based on the number of students in K-12 schools that are from racial or ethnic groups other than white. And so we do reserve funds. This year we reserved 32%. It was essentially the same percentage point. And then I've provided a good amount of data for you to review based on how much we've spent in the last year. We received 530 applications, and this was one of those programs that got some one-time funding. So in the 2015 legislative session, 2016 legislative session, $2.8 million was appropriated in one-time funds to this program. Unfortunately, in that first year, there was no administrative funds, so we were doing as much as we could without, you know, trying to find staff to work on it. And then the last legislative session, we were given some administrative funds for the program. We're allowed to use an allowance, and so we started working on it right away, and we're able to start making awards and dispersing funds to eligible students. And as of this week, we've dispersed a little over $3 million in teacher candidate grants. And you can see, based on the reserve, we also, of that $3 million, a little over $900,000 was to teacher candidates from racial ethnic groups that are underrepresented in the teacher workforce. One thing that I think is important to point out is that we've essentially spent all of the one-time funds, as well as the annual appropriation that was given to this program. So coming next year, instead of having $3 million, we will have $1 million. So there will be much fewer grants going out, but still $1 million in, I'm sure there will be enough applicants. So if you have any other questions about, you know, where the money is going, who's applied, that kind of stuff, some of that's here. Otherwise, you can feel free to ask as well.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzgibbons. And I do have a question, and then I see Representative Erickson has one as well. So we did in the budget bill that we passed last year allowed some of those funds to be spent for your administrative purposes, because I think at the time when we looked at the appropriation, basically none of the funds had gone out the door. And I appreciate this very detailed information on the number of students and where they're going to school. So for the money that's been allocated, is that all for what? For like this fall semester now that students started, or the spring, or how would you guess that's going out?
Chair, and committee, it's not 50%, but it's in both fall and spring semesters. Spring was a little bit higher than fall, but I can't remember the numbers right off the top of my head. We can provide them to you later, but it was a little bit higher in the spring, but not significantly higher.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Fitzgibbons. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going to the chart, to our most recent testifier, I was listening to your answer to Representative Loon, but are you saying that some of these awardees are still in the student teaching mode, or have all of these recipients completed student teaching?
Representative Evans and Chair Loon, some of these are still in student teaching because it's been dispersed for this semester, so they haven't finished their student teaching and will finish it at the end of this school year.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. Do you know if those who completed their student teaching now have jobs or have applied for jobs or, been licensed so that they can proceed into the field?
Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Representative Erickson, Sherilyn, we don't have that data right now. I'm assuming we will do some kind of follow-up for our report for the next legislative session that will have some outcome data on where the student teachers are now. And we can hopefully we'll be able to get some of that from the Minnesota Department of Education and PELSB and the licensing data. We can do some matching. So,
Madam Chair,
President Erickson.
I think that follow-up report will be very important for us to see how beneficial mm-hmm. this program plays out. Dependent on their being in our classrooms. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right. Other questions? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And good to see you again as well.
And likewise.
Ms. Fitzsimmons, these are, and this is not meant to be judgmental at all on either us or you. It's just an observation of fact. So one-time appropriations. So speak a little bit about, if you could, about the, and this will be highly subjective, no doubt, but your wisdom in terms of the need to continue with something like this, number one. And then two, if you could tell us a little bit about, for us to get a feel for how much work did it take for the department to capacitate itself to be able to deliver this. I can imagine, I'll say this, you don't need to, and this, again, this is not a judgment on our decision here, but I can imagine that with the guarantee of one-time resources, that makes it, I would think that would make it real difficult to get into a capacitation mold that can be highly effective, thinking that, this could all go away next year. And so that's just me, in terms of making that statement. But tell us a little bit about what were the challenges in terms of capacitating for this and what the wisdom is in terms of what you're seeing, its impact. I know the report's not ready yet. In terms of advising us to either go forward with bigger and more permanent appropriations or, nice experiment, go do something else.
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Representative Mariani and Chair Loon, There, at least, I believe it's in the tails for the next. We do have regular ongoing funding of $500,000 in each year.
Okay.
But we did have that pretty significant one-time appropriation of $2.8 million, and so I can tell you personally because I looked at all 527 applications for this, that there is, and because we didn't have a significant amount of administrative funding available in the beginning of this program, we didn't have the capacity to set up a database, to set up an online application, to do all those types of things. That it took a significant amount of my time to manually read applications, type them into a database, keep track of them, collect awards, review all the stuff. It was pretty significant. Now that we have some ongoing funding, we'll be able to do a little bit more in terms of setting up an online application so it's easier for students to apply, doing some more work there. The one good thing about our office is that with the exception of the fact that I had to learn a lot about student teaching and how teacher prep programs work, when it comes to putting together a financial aid program, we're kind of we're the go-to place. So we have the system set up to get the money to the schools quickly. So it was more about the learning curve in our office, for me in particular, in learning how the teacher prep programs work, because most of that it happens over at MDE and at the now Pelsby. So,
Representative Mariani.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And my bad, Madam Chair, I missed the tails part. So it's really the two amounts that came together over the last couple of years.
There is an ongoing appropriation, but we kind of supersized it when we had some one-time money in 2016.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, just a quick observation, I know that this is, kind of new territory for Office of Higher Ed, right? But it seems to me that one of the advantages here is that perhaps that we're able to centralize a very important function here that prior to that was decentralized to the different, respective colleges. And I think that should put us in a better position to get a stronger feel for what types of investments, how much, and perhaps even pointing toward, better ways for us to hold the quote-unquote system accountable as opposed to, tracking down so many different teacher prep schools across the state. So I certainly hope that we'll be able to continue to make some decent investments going forward for many, many years here.
Yeah, thank you. I would share those thoughts, Representative Mariani, and I think we do a lot of great things here that we fund in the committee, but I'm really excited about the prospect of this, especially looking at the shortage teacher licensure areas and then also encouraging more diversity in our teaching pool and trying to help reach those students where student teaching is really a financial hardship for them. And so I do think it's a great program. I'm glad you're getting the money out the door, and we'll be looking forward to that follow-up report when you have it. Thank you. Ms. Oliver, one question for you as well. Just in terms of the alternative teacher prep programs, you mentioned that you needed to kind of do a little bit of work to kind of get up to speed with stakeholders in that. Could you talk a little bit about that process and who you were able to bring together to kind of get this grant program up and off the ground?
Great. Chair Loon, committee members. So post-session, I was merged into being the manager over our grants department, which is a one-person department, and the government relations. And I now have another employee who handles all of our competitive grants. And we got several new ones. And we also do the legislatively named grants, which we have 11 of. So I took it to kind of help mitigate some of that work to take on this one, which is new to our office as well. And I understand you all made some changes to the statute regarding alternative teacher prep, becoming an alternative teacher prep program. I've had meetings with Ed Minnesota, what was the Board of Teaching, now Pelsby, the executive director of that has provided some feedback. And I've just gotten some cards from some other folks that are willing to chip in some information. There's also this fine line of conflict of interest because some of those places will be applying. So I do have to just work mostly, I guess, with the Pelsby team on this as well, since they're the ones that would give approval for someone to become an alternative teacher prep program. And because it's one-time funding and limited, trying to make sure it does what you all intended and goes to who all you intended it to go to for the right purposes is something that we've been working on as well. It could take 6 or more months to just develop RFPs. We have a lot of policy, state policies in place for the procedure for that. One, for example, is the posting of the RFP has to be posted for 30 to 45 days. So that's already a month to 2 months there. So I have been keeping certain stakeholders in the loop, the people have who have expressed interest in applying, letting them know kind of where I'm at in the status of the program. So that's kind of been what's been happening as of late.
All right, thank you. And so looking at your timeline, so you would anticipate that, on March 5th the RFP will go out?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. All right. I appreciate that clarification. Any other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Oliver, are you able to give us an idea of who might have shown some interest after this became law? Did you get some interested party calling, wondering?
Ms. Oliver.
Chair Hoon, Representative.
Teach for America.
Teach for America.
Representative Erickson. Chair, I was in the room too when we were there. I think it was the a man from the Lakes Area Cooperative.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Some school foundations, actually. College foundations expressing interest. I also attended the Board of Teaching's informational meeting they held to talk to school districts, other organizations about how to become an alternative teacher program, and all of those people obviously expressed interest in the funding. So,
thank you very much. That was very helpful.
Thank you. All right, and then let's see, we've got one more program to cover. That is the Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment or Forgiveness Program. Ms. Tippin.
Chair, the Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program was set into law in 2015, and then we used the first year of the program to establish rules. So there are rules for this program. One of those things we clarified in the rules was that we were going to call it the Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program, even though in the statute it's called the Forgiveness Program, because we make payments to people and they are repaying their loans with those funds. We don't have the authority to forgive the loans, so we just do that to make it more clear for the the people who are applying for it. As I said, it's a student loan debt relief program. We provide repayment awards to eligible teachers of up to $1,000 each year and up to 5 annual awards. They do have to hold a teaching license issued by the now Pelsby, be employed to provide classroom instruction by a school district, and be fully licensed and teach in a designated shortage area. There are three currently ways that someone can be working in a teacher shortage area. One is an economic development region that's considered a shortage area within the state. One is a statewide shortage area by their teacher licensure field. And then we actually are able to get data from the licensing division of MDE and MDE itself. Like teacher licensure fields within economic development regions that are shortage areas. And then next year, which was a change from the last legislative session, there is a fourth shortage area, which is licensed teachers who are belong to racial ethnic groups that are in high demand in the or show in the Teacher Minnesota teacher workforce. And that will be effective in our next application round. We do have a report. I believe you have been given copies of the report that was issued in February at the beginning of this month. And then I've actually provided some additional data on the handout for this year because we are just in the process of awarding and then dispersing in the next few weeks the awards for this year. So we won't. This will be our second time of awarding. We've received over 1,000 applications this year and are able to issue awards to a little over 800 at this point. There's lots of teachers that are benefiting from the program. This is another program that we did have a one-time $1 million appropriation to, but we have ongoing funding as well that we're continuing to use over the next few years. So,
great. Glad to hear that you've got lots of interest in applications. So, any other questions for either Ms. Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the report, page 18, recipients, and that elementary education was the most applied for and awarded. Do you know what the ethnic makeup of that might have been, you know, considering that's part of the award?
Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Representative Erickson, Chair Loon, we, in the first round and even in the second application round for the Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program, we did not collect racial, ethnic, ethnicity. Obviously, going into the next round, we'll have that information. But you can you could potentially use some of the information from the Teacher Candidate Grant at some point because there are. It's also the number one teacher licensure or teacher license that the Teacher Candidate Grant recipients are seeking as well as elementary education. So we'll have some more information there probably in next year's report as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you. Any other questions for either Ms. Oliver or Ms. Fitzgibbon? All right. If not, I think we'll move on to our next topic areas. Thank you very much to both of you for being here. We appreciate your information and all that you're doing to help get these grant programs up and running. Thank you so much. All right. So next, we will hear from the Department of Education. Mr. Uni, you want to come forward? Okay, and members, the green packet in your folders starts the top page is the Grow Your Own Grant Program. And the department's got several programs that they're going to be talking about. So, welcome.
We do. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss these programs. I'll be walking through six programs, starting with Grow Your Own. I'll be discussing the top-level details, including just what the funding was, just a brief description of what the program does, as well as some numbers on who was funded. For many of these programs, I currently don't have outcome data, but I can certainly, in the areas that we do, should questions come up around that, I would shoot that data and send that to the committee at the earliest possible time. So, Madam Chair, I'll start out with, as you mentioned, the Grow Your Own program. This was initially funded in 2016 and then funded again in 2017 with some programmatic changes. The initial appropriation in 2016 was $1.5 million for 2017 or fiscal 17 and $1 million in years thereafter. It was four programs in the cities of the first class or districts with four student populations of 40% or more of minority students or American Indian students. These were to set up tuition scholarship and stipend programs to eligible employees to participate in board-approved non-conventional teacher residency pilots. And the eligible employees were education or teaching assistants or other non-licensed employees of the district who held bachelor's degrees from an accredited college who were intent on seeking licensure. And the detail, the non-conventional teacher residency pilots are experimental programs in learning or management run by a district and granted a waiver or a charter and granted a waiver by the PELSBY, the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board. So the recipients for 2016, as you can see on the sheet, were three districts, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Northeast Metro 916 for $1.5 million. In 2017, last session, the program received ongoing funding at $1.5 million in the base starting in fiscal 18. And this is the programmatic change opened it up to more districts to participate. It was grants to districts with more than 30% minority students. And not only did it open up the threshold of who could, which districts or charters could qualify, but it also expanded the programs that they could start. In addition to the non-conventional residency programs for district employees that I mentioned before to be able to seek licensure by receiving scholarships and stipends through the non-conventional residency programs, it also allowed districts to create introduction to teaching or introduction to education post-secondary courses for their students. So essentially grow your own program for secondary students to encourage them to enter the teaching profession. The non-conventional residency program is fairly similar. The requirements are fairly similar to 2016 with just a few changes. The districts are now strongly encouraged to recruit candidates of color and American Indian candidates, and the districts who provide the financial support were able to ask for a commitment of up to 5 years for the teacher to teach in their district. The Grow Your Own program for secondary students encouraged high school students to pursue teaching and develop the dual credit courses, post-secondary courses. All programs have to report to the commissioner. And it's different from before. MDE was able to retain up to 3% of the appropriation for monitoring and administration. If you look on the second sheet of that handout, we see that the recipients are there. You see five of the recipients had teacher residency programs, and nine actually started high school student programs. And as you can see, the expenditures were $1,455,000 for the recipients, and $45,000 was retained for administration and monitoring. Madam Chair, I can stand for any questions on this program.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ooney. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ooney, what do we know about the licensure areas that these candidates are have either gone into or are preparing for? If I remember correctly, the Minneapolis program at least was or still is exclusively for elementary teachers. I'm wondering about the if there's broader distribution across other licensure areas in the other programs.
Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I haven't delved into that level of detail with staff who run the program. Just anecdotal evidence, I've heard there's possible focus on special education, teachers, and that type of area. So I would imagine that some are looking at specializing the types of teachers that they're trying to bring on board. But I'm more than happy to go back to staff and take a look at what type of specialized programs other than possible just grade bands.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You. Any other questions on Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just sitting here looking at this data and thinking that perhaps this year we should put in a provision so that we know some of the information that Representative Dabney's asking for and whether or not the high school student program does reap us benefits and they do actually enter the profession. So maybe we want to look at some reporting to that effect for next year.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Ooney.
Representative Erickson, one thing I skipped over in my review that I did write on the pages, we do have an annual report to the commissioner on those programs with the number of participants, the ethnicity of the participants, and the assessment of the program effectiveness. So I imagine that in those reports we'll capture some of the information. So I'd be happy to, again, go back to staff and see what the breadth of that information is, and if there needs to be any tightened language, we can certainly meet online and discuss any further
details. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you,
sir. All right. Thank you, Bo. All right. Not seeing any other questions, I guess we'll just keep moving down the list of programs. You've got quite a grouping of them.
Madam Chair. Okay, so the second one, Madam Chair, committee members, is the Agricultural Educator Grant Program. This, again, was first funded in 2016 and then funded on an ongoing basis in 2017. So essentially with those combined two pieces of legislation, it's $250,000 in an ongoing fashion per fiscal year. The grants are to support districts to pay agricultural educators for summer work with high school students. on their programs. It's got to be a one-to-one district match for the teachers' employment. The state chair is limited to funding one half of 40 working days. And then, as with many programs, recipients have to annually report to the commissioner. And for this, on the number of teachers funded and outcomes compared to the goals that they set out in their application. And as you can see, there's a list of districts that were awarded funding for 2016, as well as on the second page, you can see for 2017. Just as some anecdotal evidence for, not anecdotal evidence, I should say, for some of the outcomes for those grants. In 2017, 43 programs were funded and 63 teachers were funded partially through this program. And then I've been told that for 2018, we're going to be able to fund 46 programs and 72 teachers. Madam Chair, I can stand for any questions on this program.
Okay, thank you. I guess just one question. Do you have more requests for funding than we were able to accommodate with this grant program?
Well, Madam Chair, if you look at the 2016 grant, we had a carryover of $16,523. So based on that, and I haven't asked the staff that direct question, I can go just to make sure, but it looks like 2016 there was not. I am not sure about 2017. I can certainly ask staff if there was more demand than is existing.
All right. Thank you. All right. If there are no questions on this, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Uni, are you going to provide us with a chart like you did with Grow Your Own, et cetera, that, you know, it shows this data so we have it actually in print on the awards and number of teachers and which districts?
Representative Erickson, on my sheet, I'm not sure on your sheet, there's two tables on the front page for the agricultural educator grant for the 2016 awards. It doesn't include the number of teachers, but it does include the districts and the amount that they were awarded. I'm not sure if you have the same sheet that I'm working off of, Representative.
Maybe you're missing a sheet, Representative Erickson. We'll get one to you.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, though, you do bring up a good point. I'd be happy to provide the data on where the teachers and programs were funded at the particular districts, what the distribution was. I can certainly provide that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Uni. All right. And we're getting Representative Erickson the sheet that should be in your packets.
Thank you.
All right.
No, I got one now. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Any other questions on the agriculture educator grants?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. This is very good, and I apologize for pushing you into another report, but this is very good. Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, that's my job. More than happy.
Thank you.
Don't have to send
me an email. All right. Teacher-governed school grants.
Madam Chair, committee members, teacher-governed school grant program was funded in 2016. It was $500,000 for fiscal year 17. There's two grants. There's the planning grant and the implementation grant. Planning grant is for the first year of up to $50,000. Implementation grant is for $100,000 during the following 2 years. As you can see, our first round was 10 planning grants spread over schools at five districts. The initiation of these teacher-governed schools comes under the site-governed school statute, which has the same procedures. But in this situation, the licensed district professionals submit a site proposal to the school board. The board and the board approves it, and then the board and the bargaining unit that is in question enter in a memorandum of understanding around the length of school year and day and the selection of teachers and staff. And then the teacher governed license, the site allows teachers to engage in several models of innovative leadership and governance around schools, and it gives them the control to enact these policies, like providing curriculum and assessment, developing organizational models, revenue allocation, and asserting more autonomy and leadership. There's a fuller list there. And as I mentioned, the two grants of planning and implementation. And then, again, as I mentioned, they will be providing us some reports. I believe we had an interim report in June And I think in this coming summer, we will have a more rigorous, yes, June 29th of this year, we'll have a final grant evaluation report that the recipients will be providing to the department. Madam Chair, I can stand for any questions on this program.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Uni. Again, I'm just kind of curious as to interest in this, and I think we're always looking for – we're trying to promote innovation, and this is one of the grants that we have out there to encourage that. Is there anything more that you can tell us? I mean, I'm about what the prospects look like for these schools to move into the implementation stage, and assuming they're all planning to move forward with it, or is it possible that some of them enter the planning stage and then don't move forward?
Madam Chair, I think with any grant that could always be the case, but just looking at anecdotal evidence that I've received from staff, and again, coming from a non-practitioner background, I can't give a true analysis of the success rate coming out of this, but it does look like there are some robust plans coming from these schools in terms of setting up their models. The one thing that staff noted from their analysis of these proposals and their interim evaluations was that there needed to be more buy-in from district administration up front to be able to facilitate this leadership at the site level. But they feel that, you know, since these districts and school sites have been, you know, self-reflected upon that need, or at least demonstrated that, where our staff could read into that, that does show some promise moving into the second years for implementation. I could certainly follow up and see if there's any issues around, because we're closing in on 4 months out from the program evaluation, so I can certainly follow up and see if there's any concerns there about any district continuing. And again, as your first question was there more demand than dollars were available?
Thank you, Mr. Uni. Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, Representative, my apologies. Thank you for the correction. But that's important for our internal notes as well. Get that right, so we'll make sure to get that right.
Yes, and they are very proud of their school, it's, as they should be.
It's where my kids went.
All right. Other comments or questions about the teacher-governed school grants? All right. We'll move on then to the CTE consortium funding.
Madam Chair, committee members, the Rural Career and Technical Education Consortium grant was funded in 2017. It's a four-year grant in two phases, essentially. The first phase for fiscal 18 and 19 is $1.5 million per year. It's a collaboration of the Southwest West Central Service Cooperative, Southwest State Minnesota University, Minnesota West Canadian Technical College, Ridgewater College, and other partners. The fiscal 20 and 21, $3 million per year. I believe that collaborative continues that I mentioned, and then another one for a South my apologies. This is for a South Central Service Cooperative or Southeast Service Cooperative Consortium, and for a consortium including the Northwest Service Cooperative or Northeast Service Cooperative. So the consortium, essentially a voluntary collaboration for service co-ops and other public and private partners. As the name indicates, it's for providing career and technical education opportunities within their service area. It's got a range of components. You develop courses focused on the needs of the regional economy, facilitate the development of students that have the skills that are in demand of those economies in that region, improve access to CTE programs for students in rural schools, provide capital startup costs for any type of programs, and increase awareness of these courses and training. These consortiums have to have an advisory group or advisory committee. They can receive other sources of funding other than the state funding they've received. And not only will MDE get a report annually, but the legislature as well. And I believe that first one will be January of next year. I'm sure I can stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ernie. And I know this was new with the budget bill that was passed last year, so really just went out the door July 1st, so it's still really in the infancy stages. But it holds exciting possibilities for some of our areas of the state. So any particular questions for Mr. Ooney on this program? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ooney, so we have expended $138,500, but wasn't the appropriation a million?
Madam Chair, that was going to be the next, or Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, that was going to be the next program I was going to go to. It's,
okay.
The names are so similar that the one.
Oh, you're right. I better pay attention here. I'm preoccupied,
but
I guess.
These names are very similar, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson.
Yeah, okay. Yes.
We have several innovation zones and consortiums. And
yeah, my head is swirling after this morning, so sorry.
Yes. We do have a lot of programs. So, all right. Why don't we just go ahead and then talk about the Career Certification Incentive Program?
Madam Chair, committee members, the Career Certification Incentive Revenue Program, it's passed in 2016, revenue for 2017. It was $1 million appropriated for these certificates. They'd be earned for students that earned them in 2016 and 17 school year. So it's a revenue program as opposed to these other programs, which are grant programs. This is a revenue program. Our school finance team actually runs this program as opposed to our grants team under agency finance, which run all those other programs. So it truly is a distinct program from all the other ones that I've been discussing today on the recovery school grants. The district's aid equals $500 times the district's number of students who enrolled who obtained one or more qualifying certificates. So to identify those qualifying certificates and an MDE team out of our Office of Career and College Success, they consulted the Governor's Workforce Development Council and the P20 partnership to establish the universe of qualifying certificates. These names of the certificates are posted on MDE's website. There are 109 qualifying certificates noted the website on the info sheet. Just a little bit of context, they have to be in fields where occupational opportunities exist. So that cut off, some of the certifications that didn't really have representation of the occupation in the field. Those came out of discussions between MDE, the Workforce Development Council, and the P20 partnership. District participation, the school boards may adopt a policy to allow them to complete a certificate, and the certificate can be completed during regular course, so they don't have to be completed on the weekend or after school or before school. It can be completed during school. We saw that 277 qualified industry-recognized certificates were awarded. 39 students received them in grades 9 through 10, 238 in grades 11 through 12. You can see the list of 7 recipients who participated in the program and received funding. And, Madam Chair, to Representative Erickson's question, there was $1 million allocated and only $138,500. It's an issue of demand. I think it's for several reasons. One, the money was given in 2016 and had to be given for credentials received in the 16-17 school year. So the timeline, I think, for districts, at least from what staff is telling me in terms of their conversations, was quite aggressive for them to be able to get their programs up. We did advertise it. I know my colleague Caitlin Snyder and I and Dr. Melcher advertised it statewide in our talks around the state. I know our Office of Career and College Success talked about it. I believe we've put it out in certain mailings. But they simply found that some districts either did not find themselves to be aware enough of the program as they should have, as well as, despite our what we thought were clear indications, fully understanding how much money they could actually get. In conversations with some districts that were not on the list, that maybe we think should be on the list, simply came back and were surprised that they could receive that much money. We've tried to be very cautious and conservative about how we're implementing this law, about where we're giving the money out for when the awards were certificates were awarded. We are constrained by that 2016-17 school year. So there is funding left over. And there's, I believe there's time. I can go back to staff and get a more detailed analysis of kind of what that looks like, but that's kind of the description of the challenges that we have about getting that funding out the door. I think it really lays in the 16-17 school year. I think if we had this current school year, possibly next school year, I think we'd see not only more demand, but you'd see that number of that 138,500 climbing upward.
And Mr. Uni, so I'm assuming there's more districts throughout our state that are doing certificate programs than are represented on this list, because it's a pretty short list of school districts. So, again, it sounds like maybe they just needed more information or lead time to know that they may have certificate programs for the students that would qualify for this funding?
Madam Chair, yes. I think it's just a mixture of the reasons that you mentioned and I mentioned earlier. I think for these programs, it's a new funding flow, and even though it's a good opportunity rather than a mandate, it still takes time for districts to get the ball rolling on things, to get the programs up and going, and to fully recognize what the opportunity is. Again, I think we can go. I think the knowledge is out there more now about this, the existence of this opportunity. So I think if there should be another go around, I think there would be more success in seeing that, in terms of seeing that list grow.
All right. Thank you. Other questions, Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when we designed this program, this is $500 per student if they get this award. What's the $500 used toward?
Well, the money actually goes to the school, to the district.
Then, in turn, what do they do with it? Pay a teacher, or a professional?
I don't recall if there was any particular restrictions. Mr. Strom, do you recall if we put parameters around that?
Madam Chair, I don't believe there were parameters around it. My memory may be faulty on this, but I think part of it was some of these certificates come with a cost for participating in the test that results in the certificate. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's one of the bigger costs that districts are using that money for.
Yes, that was my reflection as well. So,
well,
Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair, I will check with Elk River, since that's just south of me, and find out, because they, I'm happy to see, did award 47. Had a $23,500. I'm very proud of them. So I'll check on that.
Yes, I know there have been some schools in some states that have used this concept very successfully, and I know in a recent tour of the technical college in my area, there can be some great opportunities for students, especially if they're coming out of high school with some certificates. That kind of gives them a leg up into career readiness and maybe partnering with some additional schooling at a technical college to get them off into a career in a pretty quick manner. So, I think we do need to kind of dig into maybe our timeline with one-time funding. I think we kind of assumed it would get scooped up very quickly, and maybe we needed to give schools a little more time to become aware of this opportunity. So, other questions? Representative Erickson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm sorry to be such a bothersome member today, but I want to go back to the rural, well, when I'm chairing, I never get to ask questions. I have to call on my members. So
questions are not bothersome.
Here I get a chance to ask questions. So back to the Rural Career and Technical Consortium, which we've just gotten that off the ground. What have you heard so far? You might recall last year, I had some concerns about the tails, but, maybe this will work out really well. I thought $3 million going out for, a couple of those, and that it just seemed to be limited. It wasn't going statewide. So what have you heard so far about what they actually are organizing? Because I imagine they're still in the planning organizational stage.
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, you're correct. This is very much in the initial phases. I've gone to staff and asked them for some perspective on what they're hearing back from the districts in terms of technical assistance they're requesting or any, you know, interim feedback they're getting. I'm still waiting on the information from staff. I think they're still compiling it, but I'd be more than happy to kind of get you some evidence, some anecdotes, and whatever else we can provide for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Ernie and Madam Chair. You know, there's such a cry when I'm up out and about for technical and career education. So I'm just a little disappointed that, like you said earlier, we haven't seen all of this grabbed up and they're just going, this is new, I realize, but, you know, in the certification incentive, I think we need to market differently. Because I don't know if they really know about these. That's what I find out when I'm out. They didn't really know about this. So, and I know you're probably sending out missiles, but maybe something else needs to happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. I think a point well taken. We do a lot of good things, but I'm sure that schools have a lot of information coming at them, especially after a session about anything that we do, and getting that information in a timely way and then getting it in time to make adjustments to their programs. Maybe we need to offer them a little more lead time with that. So, all right. Any other questions on these particular programs, CTE or career certification? Not. We'll go ahead and talk about recovery program grants.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is the final program. It's the grant program. If you remember, this was first funded in 2014, started in fiscal 15. So I believe what this was the fourth year. The program is now at $750,000 in fiscal 18 and years thereafter. The program, when it started in fiscal 15, was $500,000 per year. This covers grants of up to $125,000 per approved recovery program. The approved recovery program that to get approved through our process has to go through first providing evidence of a set of assurances that round out what a recovery program is. And then we evaluate the programs for what they're needing for their programmatic purposes. The purpose of the recovery programs is they offer a course of instruction for academic services, recovery assistance, and continuing care for those students recovering from substance abuse or dependency. Of the $125,000 that a recipient could receive, they can use it for licensed support staff, for a portion of the licensed support staff. We've laid out that it can't fully fund a staff member. There needs to be kind of a match at that level. But this can cover alcohol and chemical dependency counselors, school counselors, school psychologists, school nurses, and school social workers. In 2017, there was an addition. This funding can cover approved people transportation costs around this delivering these programmatic services. And as you can see, the recent batch of recipients are on this list. You can see the amounts they received. We did have a seventh applicant who was initially approved after going back and taking a harder look at that program. We realized that they were ineligible. And so we're currently in the process of talking with the six recipients about revising their budgets up to a maximum of $125,000.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ooney. And I think Representative Tice, this was a bill that you carried.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is. One of the schools in my district is McKinley Area Learning Center, and they have had such success. And I was so impressed by the passion and caring of the staff and why it was so important that I'm so glad that we did get some funding, because it truly makes a difference. And a lot of times with the recovery programs, it's one day at a time, one step at a time. And so it's really nice to have the extra, I want to say, recognition and support for the program.
All right. Very good. And I know Representative Slocum has also worked on this for these schools, too, for many years. So I think we had very powerful testimony, as I recall, from last year when we looked at this. And we do have someone here to talk about the McKinley Recovery Schools. Ms. Green, if you want to come forward.
show you breakfast.
All right. Well, welcome to the Education Finance Committee. And if you would just state your name so we have that on the record, and we welcome your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Shelley Goodman. I'm the director of the McKinley Recovery School in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
All right. Welcome. And if you would speak right into the microphone so we can hear you there, then we'll pick you up on the tape as well.
All right. Alert from Pronto app.
Sorry.
No internet.
So I have a video I wanted to provide. It talks a little bit about what we do, and it's only 3 minutes long. And then any questions that you might have about our school and the process, I'd be happy to. Yes.
I think there is in. Oh, here we go.
It's important to understand that everyone in the world has addictions, or rather, natural addictions, to things that are good, like food, water, and sleep. These natural addictions are important for our health and survival, and without them, we would not hunger or crave the things we need to survive. Now, we aren't exactly born with these natural addictions. Our body creates them. Let's look at an example. When you bite into an apple, your brain says, yum. Your brain recognizes that this apple is good for you. It has nutrition, vitamins, and gives your body the energy it needs to survive. Whenever the brain recognizes something that's good, it releases a chemical called dopamine. Dopamine causes you to experience pleasure. It's what makes you feel good, like when biting into an apple. The brain releases this dopamine in order to teach the body that this is healthy and good for your survival, and that it should remember to do it again. Now, there are other things we do that can release the pleasurable dopamine, like playing video games, exercising, or reading a good book. However, the amount of dopamine released during these activities is less than what's released when we eat food. The brain does this so it can recognize which is more important. So if you go 2 days without reading a book, or 2 days without eating food, your body is going to crave the food over the book. As such, your brain creates what's called a hierarchy of survival, which ranks how important each of these things is to your survival. Now, there are some things that will not cause the release of dopamine, like eating soap or punching yourself in the face. The brain knows that these things are not good and therefore does not release the pleasurable dopamine because your brain does not want you to do it again. Now, let's look at alcohol, marijuana, tobacco, and other drugs. These are all classified carcinogens, proven to cause cancer and other fatal diseases. Now, your brain should recognize that these things are harmful to your body. However, these substances have special chemical characteristics that fool the brain into releasing dopamine, oftentimes in much greater amounts than the body has ever experienced before. Because of this, the body is fooled into thinking that these things are good and important, sometimes even more important than food, water, or sleep, and consequently hijacks the number one spot in your survival hierarchy. So now, if you go 2 days without eating or 2 days without drinking alcohol, your body will actually crave the alcohol over the food. This is an extreme case of addiction, where the person addicted believes that they will die if they don't get it. The severity of the addiction depends on where the alcohol or drug lies within your hierarchy of survival, and can increase even with casual use. Research shows that people under the age of 21 are at the highest risk of having their survival hierarchy hijacked. Why? Because their brains are still growing and developing and are hypersensitive to false shocks of dopamine caused by these harmful substances. By 21, the brain is more fully developed and mature, and the survival hierarchy becomes more permanent and less susceptible to getting hijacked. The flip side is that once you are 21, it becomes very difficult to remove these harmful substances from your survival hierarchy. Studies show that 9 out of 10 people who currently struggle with addiction started drinking, smoking, or using before the age of 21. Understanding addiction as a preventable disease can help save millions of lives. The decision to wait until 21 could mean the difference between a life enslaved by addiction or a life full of success and accomplishment. Want to learn more?
Thank you very much. All right. So I use this 3-minute video as an education for many of the teens that I work with because when I talk about never using substances, that's a long time for them. But if I tell them at least delay until age 21 before this experimentation happens, then their brain is fully developed, and they have much more success if they wait until after that than when they're teenagers. So 90% of adults with chronic substance use disorders who fill our prisons, who take up a lot of resources simply because of their disorder and the way that it manifests itself, started using substances in the adolescent years. So that's why I wanted to play that for you. We started our school last year. We've been open for enrollment for about 12 months. We're located in a school within a school model, and we can accept from 10 to 15 students at one time. All of our students have They have substance use, have the diagnosis of substance use disorder, but most of them also have co-occurring disorders. So it's an integrated, comprehensive model. They're drug tested every week. They're expected to attend school. They are expected to make academic progress. And I can say that this, and we don't have all of the reports yet put together, but by the end of this school year, I can say that we can show great success with the students that we've enrolled. So we were one of two that started this past year. There are six in the state.
So. Okay. And Ms. Green, I'm trying to remember from last year's testimony, do you get referrals? I mean, is this where the courts have been involved and students are basically required to come be part of your program, or is it more voluntary?
Well, it is both. I have been doing a lot of outreach to treatment facilities for adolescents, also with the courts, the judges, everyone else that I can possibly tell about the recovery schools. Mainly because it is intensive and it's comprehensive in that I have contact with all of the providers that are involved with students, and sometimes a probation officer will go to court and require, you know, that they come to the recovery school. And so one of the things that's important about that piece is that when people are mandated to treatment, the outcomes are actually better than voluntary admissions. So currently, as many of you know, the mental health and chemical health systems are not as integrated as maybe they could be. And so this is an attempt to make that happen in the continuum of care. So.
Thank you. It's, you know, that surprises me just a little bit, the difference between the voluntary and mandated. But on the other hand, I guess the consequences perhaps for the mandated of not following through are unpleasant. So,
yes. There's some leverage then to try to take the external motivation, and it eventually becomes an internal motivation because it's more uncomfortable not to. And so then you can have a receptive person, you know, to offer the help with. So,
thank you. Questions for Ms. Green? I kind of interrupted you. Did you have more testimony? No.
Not okay. Unless you have questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question.
Yes.
Can we have access to that video and share it, or is it
I would
private
love to have you
copyrighted
share it.
Copy?
I don't know. Can you email me, or how do you? How would you like?
I think we have it, and we'll make sure that we'll send it out. I assume it's on a link or something. So we'll send the link
like
out
YouTube,
to the committee.
But
I think there's a lack of understanding of neurobiology and how the symptoms of substance use. We spend a lot of money, a lot of resources, and it's not necessarily it's this and that, and it's in a reactive way as opposed to a preventative way, where this is more prevention, because we know if we can get to them before the teenage years, the chances of a lifelong chronic disorder can be avoided.
Thank you. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just wanted to say thank you, Ms. Green, for the work that you do and for sharing that video. I thought it was very informative, and I think it would be beneficial for us to be able to share that with others.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm honored.
Thank you. One other question I had was, and I know one of the purposes for the grants that we allowed was transportation, and I remember some of the testimony with some of our students of, you know, maybe their families had moved or and it's a distance for them to go and to get to their recovery program was one of the reasons we did expand. Could you comment on that at all?
I can speak for our recovery school. I'm not sure how the rest of the recovery schools have utilized their funds. We applied those funds towards our support staff because, as I said, the support staff is so integral to the programming that the transportation costs are so far above all of the funding that's available. We are a joint powers ALC, so many of the children that come to the ALC are from different school districts in the area, that type of thing. And we offer Metro bus passes, and that's about it for the transportation at this point. But we did have some outlying recovery schools that were looking more at transportation funds.
Thank you. Yes, I think for more maybe pulling from rural areas, that was
it's difficult
becoming more of an issue to it's making sure difficult. We had access for those children, those students to get to their programs.
Yes, it's very difficult.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Representative Tyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say again how fortunate we are to have a program like this and to have Ms. Green here, because I every time I talk with her or I go to visit, I'm just impressed at the caring, at the passion for going forward and helping these kids get life better, so that they're making better decisions and realize the opportunities that are available to go forward. And I just can't say enough how fortunate St. Cloud area is in having the school available. Sometimes it gets a hard rap about who the students are, but, you know, life comes in many different experiences, and they are trying to make the best of some not-so-great times. So thank you again for coming. Thank you again for all that you do.
Thank you, Representative Tice. I want to say that many of history's most famous people, artists, writers, composers, have had substance use and mental health disorders, and it sometimes it's easy to forget that. So,
thank you. One last question. Yes. When how does your program measure success for its students? Yes. Is it students successfully completing the program and maybe then being mainstreamed into regular high school, or is it graduating from school, or maybe it's both?
All of the above. So right now we're looking at attendance. Many of these kids are on truancy probation through the court system. They haven't been going to school. I can say that their attendance has increased significantly. We are also tracking academic performance compared to prior to enrolling in the school, and that has significantly increased. Being drug-free and having their mental health concerns addressed is extremely important. And so some of the students we track as far as they may be able to go back to mainstream school once they've had long enough in sobriety, but it's about 1 year of sustain sobriety before you see relapse rates significantly fall off. And so when you go to treatment, these kids go 30 days to treatment, 6 weeks to treatment, and it's over and over and over again because they go to the same environment that they were using drugs in. This way, we isolate those children. We have group every day. We talk about sobriety skills. We drug test, you know. So it gives them a longer time for them to have sobriety, see what it's like to be sober, and, you know, because they've forgotten those things. So I'm hoping some great results will come in the future here.
Thank you. Well, we know you're making great efforts. We appreciate it. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So
yes, sir.
There's 15?
There's 15, 10 to 15, yep.
And so it's a school, Ms. Madam Chair.
Yes,
so it's
Representative Thiessen.
School, so they take their classes outside of the program? And how does that work?
Well, the way
Ms.
it...
Green.
That, oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
Am I supposed to...
You can go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, yes, sir. So our children are in one classroom, and they don't they're not in the ALC mixing in the other students. We also made the times for their academic classes different than the ALC, so that mix is not happening.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Representative Thiessen.
But the teachers.
Come in.
Yes, okay.
Yes, the teachers push into the classroom so that the students don't have to be out. Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, did you have your hand up? No. Okay. Other questions?
Yeah, sure.
Representative Mariani.
As we have time, I just want to echo what you said earlier, that the new approaches that seem to be more effective based on our knowledge of neurobiology.
Yes.
So applying neuroscience. And that's a big, I think, not only in education, but across the board, a learning paradigm for a lot of legislators as well, in terms of the policy base that can be informed by neurobiology and neuroscience. Representative Sandstedt and I were commenting earlier that we think the appropriate age in terms of, you know, where the brain is
yes.
now, you know, strengthened, developed, is probably closer to 25 and 27.
Exactly. Yes.
And for
yes,
young
sir.
Men, really 27.
Yeah. No, I would agree. Yeah. I think that's adolescence is extending. In fact, Madam Chair. Yeah.
Go ahead, Ms.
Do I ask permission to speak? Is that what I do?
I just oh, recognize you, but you're just fine. Go right ahead.
What I have heard, I'm a mental health therapist as well, and in psychology they have actually come up with a second adolescence, and they have a term for it. And I don't know if that's, you know, the evolution of adolescence the way it is, but it does take a while.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Mariani.
I have a 31-year-old son. I can attest to the 27 age cutoff.
Very
Thank
good.
Thank you.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Green. Again, we appreciate your testimony. Thanks for sharing your video. We'll make sure everyone has it. And thanks for being with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And I will call down. We have representatives from the Lakes Country Cooperative, Josh Nelson. All right, and while they're coming down, I would be remiss if I did not mention, Mr. Uni, great compliments to you for the handouts provided on the programs. You got high compliments from our committee administrator, so because I didn't know where they all came from, so I must pass that along because he's a tough customer, as you probably know. So, good job, thank you. All right, welcome, Mr. Walseth or Mr. Nelson, whoever wants to kick off, but thank you for being here today.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Sam Walseth, and I represent the Minnesota Service Cooperatives, including Lakes Country Service Cooperative. I'll be brief, but I just want to give the committee a little bit of a reminder of the context of where the Northwest Partnership originated from and the reason for its existence. Back in the fall of 2015, the Higher Learning Commission which is the accrediting agency for higher education institutions across, I believe, 19 states, including Minnesota, came to Minnesota and started reviewing concurrent enrollment programs in Minnesota high schools in the relationship with higher education partners. And they deemed that there was a lack of progress, for lack of a better word, about those concurrent enrollment teachers meeting an 18 graduate credit requirement for teaching those courses. And so Minnesota found itself in a situation where we have about, at that time, the survey was about 1,400 concurrent enrollment teachers in our high schools, and only about 24% of them who had the current 18 graduate credit requirement. So there's a need to find a way and a pathway to get those staff the graduate credits that they'll need to be in compliance with HLC requirements by what we understand now is the year 2022, when the HLC will come back in and start looking closer at this issue here in Minnesota. And so in the 2016 legislative session in the supplemental budget bill, thank you, Representative Nornes, and actually in the work of you, Madam Chair, in this committee, you brought forth an appropriation, a session law of $3 million to put dollars on the table for a partnership between Lakes Country Service Cooperative, Northwest Service Cooperative, and Minnesota State University in Moorhead. And they began a program with those dollars, have built a program and are serving teachers originally in the pilot area of that region, but there's some subsequent legislation from last session which has taken the program statewide. And so I just wanted to provide a little bit of background and context for what the partnership is, why it was needed. And with me today is Josh Nelson, who is the manager of educational programs at Lakes Country Service Cooperative, who can walk you through some more detail of the program. You should have in your packets an available report that was submitted to the legislature in January with an update and status on where they're at with the program. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. Nelson. And
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Walseth. Mr. Nelson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Josh Nelson, and as Sam said, I'm the manager of our education programs at Lakes Country Service Co-op. And certainly of this program, this concurrent enrollment program. I'll just highlight a couple quick things within the more detailed report. But back in September, middle of September of 2016, we were officially awarded the grant, and we went to work very quickly with Minnesota State University, Moorhead, and Northwest Service Co-op to start establishing online graduate courses for our two regions. So in our regions, in the northwest part of the state, we identified, 90 school districts and about 300, it was just north of 300 teachers who needed graduate coursework to get qualified to be able to teach concurrent enrollment classes in the high school. The Higher Learning Commission extended their requirement deadline to 2022, so there's a little bit of time on our side to get teachers qualified. So concurrent enrollment courses are still happening within our high school as we speak while we are getting teachers qualified. Like I said, we spent the fall of 2016. This is a monumental task because at Minnesota State University Moorhead, they were not accustomed to teaching graduate courses at all in many departments, and certainly not online. So it was a large learning curve for the faculty at the university, and many of them stepped up and took on the task. And so we spent about 2.5 months trying to get some professors to develop, not just develop the content, but also teach the courses online, which, again, was brand new to them. And, in fact, we started with the first three content areas that we determined based on a survey that were the highest demand. So that was math, English, and history. And we pulled it off. So in January, we offered our first, January 2017, we offered our first six courses in the three content areas, which was a huge undertaking because while the university was developing the coursework, we were working with our K-12 districts to put in place an agreement and also get teachers submitted to us who were given permission to take the courses. We didn't want any teachers to see this as an avenue to a master's degree without teaching concurrent enrollment courses, so essentially the participation agreement was on behalf of the district saying that the teachers that are enrolled in this program are intended to be used for teaching concurrent enrollment courses. Over the course of the year, we continued to build courses, and today we are at 14 courses. So we went from 6 to 14 over the course of a year, which is huge progress. We see that as huge progress. We have We have had 462 teachers statewide participate in the program, and those 462 teachers are represented by 158 different districts. So this has initially been a program that was focused on the northwest part of the state, and then, of course, during the last legislative session, the statute was amended. Even though we were serving statewide teachers, it was amended to officially focus statewide. So I will tell you, as the coordinator of the project, my phone rings every single day. I get emails every day inquiring about this program. I do have to admit that the free tuition, free books is appealing to all. And people are very, very appreciative overall, from superintendents to principals down to teachers are super appreciative of this opportunity to get those 18 credits so that they are qualified based on the Higher Learning Commission requirements. One last note, you'll see in kind of the financial piece that we did some quick math, and it isn't perfect math, but it's if you take the tuition, the amount of money that the university is charging the grant for tuition plus free books plus administering this grant, per credit, it's about up to today, it's about $370 per credit. If a teacher enrolled into the program and started acquiring master level or graduate level courses, they're charging, MSUM is charging $429 per credit just for the credit alone. So the credit books and everything is hugely discounted to the grant thanks to Minnesota State University Moorhead, and they continue to do good work for us for a very discounted price. So thank you to them. Also, thank you to our, I'd like to just quickly thank, I see Dr. Amoroso is up here, and MASA and our Secondary Principals Association has done a good job of helping us market this program. We certainly couldn't have the outreach that we've had without them, along with our service co-op partners throughout the state.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Thank you, Mr. Walseth. You know, I think it's, so far it looks like it's been a great success. And if your phone is ringing, as you say, more teachers are going to be able to avail themselves of this. Do you have a count, and maybe it's in here and I just am not looking at it, but of how many teachers are close or going to get their 18 credits so they're going to move into that fully qualified category according to the Higher Learning Commission?
We don't have those numbers, and they're very difficult for us to get. We've been working with the secondary schools or the districts that have partnered with the colleges issuing the credits to the students. They've been keeping close tabs on that, some more than others. So we would depend on them to get that data.
Okay, very good. Well, if we can find that at all, I think that would be helpful, because obviously that's the goal of trying to reach compliance so that our students can continue to take advantage of these concurrent enrollment courses, which are very valuable to them with the cost of their college education. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just wanted to comment that this is really an example of a problem that's presented, and a group of individuals, institutions, number of people that put their heads together. I attended one of the meetings, I think it was at Lakes Cafe in Perham, where they kind of outlined what their idea was. So it wasn't my idea. I had nothing to do with it, except that we did see a legislative requirement or need. And so I'm really pleased that they have done this. It's successful, and it's helping others across the state, not just the area that we started in. And compliments to Mr. Nelson, Lakes Country Co-op, and others that I think this is a good example of how we work together and address issues that need to be done. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. I would agree. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, as long as we're complimenting people, let's compliment the people that are blindly going into this program and committing themselves to the program and not knowing what's going to happen in the future, and getting these 18 credits and have this widespread regional, statewide commitment. And not only should we be thanking you for offering it and carrying it out and talking those instructors into becoming online teachers and all that, but it seems to me that everybody that's involved is making a commitment without knowing, and that's really trust in us.
Yes.
So we better not goof it up.
Yes, duly noted, and people doing it while they're working full-time jobs, so, with teachers taking that on. So it's been a vexing issue, to be sure. Some of us feeling that maybe this wasn't necessary, but, you know, there are circumstances you deal with, and I think we're just doing the best we can. And I just appreciate the manner in which sort of the creativity in bringing this forward and making it available as statewide, I think, was a good thing, and it sounds like it's definitely been in demand. So we appreciate that, and thank you very much for the information. Other questions or comments for either of these witnesses? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks very much for being here. All right, so that is kind of our overview of some of our grants and programs funded with, again, a lot of it was started with that one-time money we had in 2016, but some other programs from the budget bill last year. We have one other short item of business of House File 2845, and I would move that House File 2845 be passed and referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And I'll tell you what it is, and then I'll let Mr. Strom fill in. Just I want everyone to know, since we're just moving this quickly. You may recall one of the pilots that we did was the Rock and Read program, the singing program for reading. And we did give them a one-time grant in the 2016 supplemental, and then we also gave them some one-time money in the budget bill that we passed last year. And inadvertently, usually we give that grant money, and it's available for both years of the biennium, and somehow it was written for only the first year of the biennium. And so this I would consider just a technical correction bill, so it's the money does not run out by January 1st of this year. It's good for the full biennium, but... I'd call in Mr. Strom just to affirm or add anything to that.
Madam Chair, members, there's a bit of a description at the top of the bill summary and the overview. In brief, essentially, if there's no carryover authority, an appropriation cancels at the end of that year. The carryover, if this were to pass prior to July 1st, would come without cost to this committee against its target, as that's the general way in which these are done. In terms of the 2017 bill, nearly all the grants had carry authority, and this, I think, was one of only two that did not, Madam Chair, and I believe it was inadvertent that it was left out.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Strom. Yes, it was, and it's just one of those things that happens when you're working on things in a fairly rapid pace. So that is the bill. Are there any questions? All right. If not, I would renew my motion that House File 2845 be passed and referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Motion is agreed to. With that, members, that is our business for today. So we're getting out early. As you know, that almost never happens here. So enjoy your 6 minutes of free time today. I will just a little preview for an obviously kind of a short week for us getting started this week with other things going on. But we'll be up and ready for three hearings a week starting next week. So next week on the 27th, we'll be doing an overview on mental health. As you know, I and many other members have taken a real interest and concern with increasing need for mental health providers and assistance for our students in our schools. So we're going to be devoting a day of hearings on that. We're going to be doing an overview of the grant program. So the Department of Human Services is going to be coming to talk about that. We'll talk about the money we've provided for the intermediate schools and kind of that topic in large. We're also going to be doing a hearing on fiscal transparency with the federal state ESSA requirements. And then March 1st, we're going to be doing an overview of the forecast. So the forecast will come out on the 28th. We're going to give our fiscal analyst time to look that over. So we'll have our hearing on that on Thursday. So that's it for now. Again, any questions or ideas you have that you would like to have hearings on or other concepts, please come and talk to me. We'd be happy to accommodate you. And with that, committee is adjourned.